I feel like we're in a hybrid course. So we have a snow day, then we have a couple class days, then we have a snow day. Yeah, I would just like to have an in-person class. Thank you very much. Welcome to Marketing 25 of 10 Principles of Marketing. I'm Dr. Marks. It's February 7th, 2022, lecture 7. Lecture note page, if I have it right, is 67. Duh, I am recording, yay me. Enrollment hasn't changed too much. How we doing on masks? Masks, masks, masks. Good. Thank you. So mini test 3 closes tonight. Haven't done it. Haven't done it. Don't know what I'm talking about. I gotta talk to you after class, young lady. You said you didn't know. And extra credit number 1 closes Thursday, 11:59. The first of 10 of those, either enhanced learning extra credit through Connect, or PackBack through, well, PackBack. So let's see, here's the listing for that schedule and the one that opened last Friday and closing Thursday, extra credit number 1. No changes here because you haven't gotten this results in yet. So business in the news. This I thought was an interesting little blurb to come through given it's Black History Month and we have some discussion about entrepreneurs and we have some discussion about social responsibility, sustainable. This was cool for me. Standing among coffee giants, two guys from Gary, Indiana, are selling beans with a mission. Ask Jared Rod Johnson how he and business partner Pernell Cesar came up with Black and Bold, the name for the new upstart coffee brand, and he'll explain to you that it was all surprisingly straightforward. Brand name is an important feature of product. When we get to that fourth, that pre the marketing mix, brand name is important. We looked in the mirror and we thought about ourselves. We thought about what this journey represents. We thought about the products inside the bag. Black and Bold is what truly represents who we are and the products that we serve. So you see a bit of entrepreneurship. These guys are quitting their day jobs and starting a coffee company, and a bit about the brand image they want to build with their brand. Unlike any number of other Black-owned brands that address themselves to niche markets, think cosmetics or fashion, Black and Bold is competing in the most mass market category imaginable, coffee, which is, after water, the most consumed beverage in the U.S. How many of you guys drink coffee? How many coffee drinkers? A little over half? So here's the target market, vast, and the market competition they're going up against, the big boys. Coffee is a $47 billion industry in America, and Johnson and Cesar, neophytes with no formal training in the food business, are picking a fight with the neighborhood toughs. So a bit about entrepreneurship again. Despite the odds against it, in barely 4 years, Black and Bold has deftly maneuvered itself onto the national stage. From an inauspicious start, roasting beans in Cesar's garage, how small businesses often start, right? The duo now has a 20,000 square foot roastery in Des Moines, Iowa, and distributes their beans to 5,600 retail locations, including Target stores, which began stocking the brands last month. So here we're seeing their growth strategy. We're seeing distribution as an important part of the marketing mix. In September, ice cream behemoth Ben & Jerry's partnered with Black & Bold on a limited batch called Change is Brewing, a cold brew coffee ice cream spiked with fudge brownies and marshmallows. So a bit of co-branding between Ben & Jerry's and Black & Bold. In addition, Black & Bold does have a purpose, and it literally comes out of the bottom line. A certified B Corporation. B Corporations are honest, forwards, transparent, social cause. Black and Bold gives 5% of its profits to some 15 nonprofit groups that address the issues and needs of at-risk youth. Its charity partners include the By Degrees Foundation, which works to increase high school graduation rates, and the Urban Growers Collective, whose 11 acres of farmland on Chicago's south side truck fresh agricultural products into the city's many food deserts. So a bit of social responsibility with this Black-owned business by design from the start. Customers who want to support Black-owned enterprise now have a clear choice for the morning brew. One of the many reasons why people rock and shop with us is because we're Black-owned, and they feel as though they're going and doing shopping their values, so their target market values. But Black and Bold's unapologetic progressive stance on social issues might be too hot for some coffee drinkers. The emphasis we place on social justice could be a detriment, he said. There are a lot of people who are resistant to the idea of supporting businesses that are social impact focused. And this goes to the idea of market segmentation and the fact that you cannot satisfy everybody all the time. So he's satisfying a segment that wants to support Black-owned businesses, that wants to be involved in organizations that are socially responsible. But there's another group of people that's saying, that's not what business is. I don't want that. You never can satisfy everybody with your marketing looks, with your approach, with your strategy. Where everyone comes down on social issues, however, Johnson points out the one unassailable truth of the beverage business. If coffee isn't good, if the coffee isn't good, no one cares who owns it. The company buys Arabica beans only in its fair trade to boot. Some darn good, affordable coffee that's available with one click on Amazon, said one social media reviewer. So there's user reviews. Word of mouth like that is a useful thing for the brand since Black & Bold's numbers, profits reportedly ran less than $1 million last year, don't allow for a Procter & Gamble-sized marketing budget. Johnson hopes that the impending launch of a merchandise line, hats, hoodies, masks to start, will turn loyal customers into walking billboards and help spark the conversation about the brand. So here we are, one way of getting consumers' attention with a limited marketing budget. Yeah? Cool for them. This was a late ad. I usually only do three of these. I couldn't resist this one. No good deed goes unpunished, and it's hard to tell how your good efforts will be perceived. American Airlines celebrates Black History Month. American Airlines recognized Black History Month as an opportunity to celebrate the contributions to Black Americans that they've made to U.S. history and culture. The airline is hosting numerous events and initiatives in the air, on the ground, and in our communities to celebrate Black History Month. American Airlines understands 28 days is not enough to celebrate the achievements of Black Americans. The airline is proud to take this time to reflect on the strides American has made in better serving Black team members and customers year-round. In 2022, customers will experience more representation throughout their travel journey. American's products and services such as flagship lounges, in-flight dining, and entertainment offerings will aim to better connect with Black travelers. To how many of you does that sound pretty good as a statement for a corporate company? One person thinks that's pretty good. How many people think it's terrible? What do the other 85% of you think, please? It what?
Indifferent.
You don't think it's indifferent in the sense that you don't care about Black History Month. You don't care about how corporations respond to Black History Month. You don't care about America. How are you indifferent? Okay, all right. So I'm not sure the indifference, but anyhow, thank you, I appreciate that. To me it sounds pretty good. So this was on their site. On their Twitter posts, they use this color scheme, which is an African-American Black History Month color scheme, yeah? So far, so good, I thought. But American Airlines celebrates Black History Month, backlash. On February 1st, as part of an announcement that it will be showcasing how its team is celebrating Black History Month, the airline updated its brand logo on social media to include a frame of yellow, red, and green, the colors associated with the month. But the move caught backlash from people on Twitter, with some accusing them, the brand, of tokenism. As you recall, last time when we were talking about the things that you can do as a brand to deal better with Black History Month, tokenism was an issue or problem to be dealt with. So, Hannah Drank says, companies don't, just don't. And referring to the change in the brand logo. Adriana says, LMAO, not African American Airlines, American Airlines. And Protect Black Women says, Soul Plane? No, call me African American Airlines. So my comment here is, it can be really hard to get it right. I think American Airlines was well-intended. They seem to have a nice statement, a nice platform. Presumably they're doing good things. And yet it's hard to strike the right note with the entire community, right? And that's true. I mean, here we're focused on African Americans, Black History Month. Whether you're Irish, Jewish, gay, every time we start targeting you with a message, someone is going to find it inappropriate, inauthentic. It's really hard, especially if you're a big, massive company. Clearly, you're not a Black-owned company, right? And so it becomes a problem to be perceived as being sincere, yeah? So I just thought that was an interesting piece. Fashion students, fashion. I thought this was an interesting little piece for y'all. What's driving growth in online fashion resale? Fashion resale surged during the pandemic under a unique set of circumstances. So these are factors affecting consumer behavior. With people stuck at home during lockdowns, the need for office wear and dressy attire vanished overnight, sparking a wave of closet cleanouts. For some, financial uncertainty made selling unused apparel a necessity, while buyers sought out unique finds and deals by shopping secondhand. How many of you guys have bought any secondhand fashion, resale fashion? Holy mackerel. Wow, that's 90% of us. Online students, you? Same number. Fashion resale also benefited from the unprecedented gains in e-commerce across the board during this period. So many factors act together to affect the consumer. It's not just one thing as we try to understand what's causing this behavior. These shifts coincided with younger consumers emerging as a major focus in fashion retail. Resale benefits from Gen Z's commitment to sustainable consumption, which we've talked about before, its love of thrifting, and throwback fashion trends such as Y2K, which has brought looks from the 1990s and early 2000s back into style, has all influenced this as well. So here we are one more time talking about the importance of understanding age cohorts, in this case, Gen Z, and how they're influencing this whole thing overall. The potential in fashion resale has barely been tapped. Cohen & Company estimates the total addressable U.S. market in the range of $150 billion to $300 billion, based on those details, although only a fraction of that is being captured. Cohen expects online sales of secondhand fashion to surpass sales from physical stores for the first time in 2020. So here's market demand ideas. Forecasting. Forecasting's hard. They aren't always right. And the next paragraph in the same story seems to question the first paragraph. However, the growth in numbers of resale buyers will be more modest. Consumption of secondhand apparel is unlikely to fully enter the mainstream, given that nearly half of the respondents in a survey expressed no interest. How many of you have no interest in resale? One. Okay, and you and my wife, no interest in resale, that's not her thing. According to a 2021 survey, and nearly a third of those who had made secondhand purchases did not like the experience. So here's marketing research into consumer attitudes, yeah? Finally, we have to return one more time, please, to the Super Bowl coming up, and then actually, even when it's done, we'll have to recap it. Never mind. Colts aren't all bad. In Irish Springs Super Bowl debut, is it wrong for members of a small, isolated community to be deeply zealous about smelling good? That's a question one stinky stranger is forced to ponder in Irish Springs' first ever Super Bowl ad. Set to air during the fourth quarter, the 32nd spot titled Welcome to Irish Speed Spring was made by that ad agency. Here's what it looks like. See if you find it amusing or not. My wife didn't much care for it. See what you think.
What is this place?
Welcome to Irish Spring, friend.
Where stinkiness is unwelcome.
Bad smells must receive their correction.
Cast thy smell away!
Cast thy smell away!
Cast thy smell away!
Cast thy smell away!
Irish Spring, smell from a nice smelling place.
So, I much prefer their ancient thing, strong enough for a man, but I like it too. Anybody old enough to remember that tagline? Nobody. Okay. We noticed that no one in the category who was owning the notion of it smelling great. It felt like very fertile territory, says the ad agency folks. Testing showed that to be the case when our clients trusted us enough to take this simple but powerful insight to the extreme. So here's idea generation, research for action, ad agency partnerships. In addition to running his first commercial in the big game, the 50-year-old soap brand owned by CPG. If you see those initials, consumer packaged goods, CPG. Manufacturer Colgate-Palmolive is introducing new formulas and fragrances and has updated its logo and packaging. So we're seeing introduction of new products. We're seeing the brand be refreshed in this ad. Emily Fong Mitchell, general manager of personal care for North America at Colgate-Palmolive, says the changes are a full relaunch designed to appeal to, whoops, another age cohort, millennials and Gen Z men. The new product will start rolling out to the U.S. retailers on February 13th, just after the Super Bowl. Appealing to a new cohort group, new product rollout. NBC has received as much as $7 million for a 30-second ad during Super Bowl 56, scheduled to air on the 13th. I'd note they were selling, and we might have said this earlier, for $6.5 million, but there were very few slots left, and companies still wanted to come in late, so they bid the price up to $7 million, a bit of supply and demand at work. Last year, the Big Grain attracted 96.4 million viewers. So we're seeing a bit of how we're using our ad budget, reaching larger numbers of consumers. NBC sold out all of its Super Bowl ads across all platforms this year, NBC Telemundo and the digital platforms, including Peacock, and only a handful of pregame slots remain open. All right, so we're going to pick off with lecture notes page 67, if I got it right this time. page 105 of the textbook. We're going to continue and finish up marketing ethics and move to chapter 5. But any questions, issues, problems on anything for me just now? I'm going to let me wander up that way because I find it really hard to hear with the masks in the distance. Yes, ma'am. Comment. American Airlines.
Yeah, so like my thing is like with like these big companies is that they try to use like, I don't want to say just black people, but just like representation as a goal to make money. And like sometimes it just makes us feel like, oh, I'm just a profit. Like they're trying to make themselves look good. So like with that trend, I can understand why that was like, you know, like people were saying what they were saying because it felt like, you know, you're only trying because it's Black History Month instead of like you're not doing this all year round.
Right. So again, we can either take at face value their statements, which is how they're trying to do more and be more representative and we do it all year long, or we can be, and I don't blame you if you are, a bit cynical about it and say, yeah, you're saying that now, but it's not going to carry forward. But even if they do mean it, it still comes across as perhaps being tokenism, is perhaps not really meaning it. So they do have to generate years of, I guess, positive action.
Yeah, but I feel like if you mean something, you don't just mean something 1 month and something right. different the next month. So that's where like the whole year-round thing comes
sure.
in.
It's like, I agree.
You can't just care when it's Black History Month because that's what we're talking about.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, I get it's like businesses are there to make a profit, but now I just feel like you're just trying to take the money.
Right.
Instead of doing it year-round.
And this is really hyped because it is Black History Month. But the other point, as I say, is also true. So if you're gay and I focus on gay in my ad, then you say, what are you doing? If you're Jewish and we're focusing on Jewish in your ad at a particular point in time, they say, what are you focused on this for now? What, you know what I'm saying? So their theme is right and I think carries across, potentially, carries across any segment that we might target for a particular message. It has to be embedded throughout the year. Yeah,
just
absolutely.
Needs to be
absolutely.
Like,
yeah.
If you incorporate a white person, you're not going to focus the whole ad on just the fact that they're white. So, like, when you have a gay person in the commercial, don't focus on the fact that I'm gay.
Right.
Like, you know what I mean?
Right,
like,
I do.
So that was just my comment.
No, thank you. I appreciate that. It's good to have the perspectives. Thank you. Anybody else, anything for the good of the order? All right, so hopefully picking up where we left off last time, chapter 4. And we've been talking at the time. I didn't save it up. About how it's easy for to be criticized. Yeah. It's easy to criticize marketing in other ways other than being disingenuous. For cultural pollution. And the point we made last time is that mass media media is imprecise. It reaches people you don't intend. But advertising is necessary. It helps to fund a whole bunch of things that are important to us. And we noted that consumers can, seldom do, opt out for technologies or media that reduce or eliminate ads. But nonetheless, sometimes our message spills over to people we don't intend it for. And obsessed.
We all know sex sells. It's used in commercials, in movies, in TV. But should sex be used to sell stuff to teenagers? New provocative ads for the acne cream Clearasil have parents really upset, including Mike Galanos. I'm a parent. I'm a little upset myself here too. This is tonight's Get to the Point segment, and boy, whoo.
Let's face it, we work with some pretty open-minded people. Some of the words they used, appalling, disgusting, give you the creeps. We're talking about Clearasil here to help with teens with acne for years now. Well, they've got this May Cause Confidence campaign, a couple of racy ones. One of them here, we basically have a 16-year-old hitting on his friend's mom. Let's check it out.
Hi, guys.
Hey, I'm going to get my stuff. So, Miss Kelly, how are things? Everything good?
Yeah, thanks.
Must be lonely now that Mr. K left. I'm really good company.
Clearasil Ultra Treatment Cream.
All right, there you have it. I just don't get this. In this day and age when you've got teachers, we've done the stories, jumping in the sack with their students.
Absolutely.
Mary Kay Letourneau, we're bringing this. All right, joining me now from Washington to talk about this, Melissa Henson, she's with the Parents Television Council. She wants the ads off the air. We're going to get to her in a minute. Also from New York, Debbie Wolf, the co-founder of People Against Censorship. All right, Debbie. Like I said, I told you, we just mentioned some of the reactions. Mine is, it's disgusting. How are you supporting this ad?
It's not so much the ad that I'm supporting as the right to air it and being against people looking to pull things off the air. Our country is full of people with very different moral compasses, and for one group or even two groups to say you should listen to my moral compass instead of everybody else's concerns me. I thought the ads were funny. I thought they were over the top. And if you look at all three of them, I really don't see how you can't get the humor.
Okay. But when you mention censorship like that, personally, I think an ad is worse than a show because the ad is like an ambush. I don't know it's coming. All of a sudden, 30 seconds later, before I can even grab the remote and change the dial, this has happened. Now I have to have a talk with my 12-year-old. What do you think of that?
I don't see how you can hold advertisers to a higher moral standard than you can to pop culture in general. When you have people looking at Britney Spears, looking at Paris Hilton, looking at everything that's on television, why is Clearasil held to a higher standard? Because they made a joke that you find offensive. It's funny. Do you really think Clearasil is advocating young boys to hit on their friends' mothers? That's just silly.
Granted, there is a humor in there, but what does my 15-year-old understand that? Let's show the next one. This one basically deals with a 16-year-old sex pot. Let's check this one out.
Here's her first tooth. Isn't she cute?
Yeah.
Oh, and here she is, naked in the bath.
You should see me now.
No.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. All right, who are the players here? Let's stay with you, Debbie, on this one real quick. Mom's a powerless buffoon. You got horny, awkward teen in the middle, and the girl's the sex bot. Do we really need to sex up our teens any more than they already are?
I don't know. I don't know where we got 16-year-olds, first of all. I don't see
she doesn't look much older than that, but go ahead. Make your point.
I'm not sure how we know that the boy is horny either. But you asked where the parents come in on this, or how does my daughter respond to this? How do my children respond to it? The response is because you as a parent are there, and you're watching this commercial, and you have an opportunity to explain to your children how they should react. If you look on the message boards that are attacking this ad, there are also people saying, my daughter, my son looked at that and thought that was awful. That's because they educated their children to the moral code that they are seeking. And that's how you deal with ads like this.
Well, I shouldn't be forced by Clearasil or anybody else to have this conversation when my son or daughter isn't ready. Let's get Melissa Henson in on this, again, with the Parents Television Council. Am I being overly sensitive or a prude on this one, Melissa?
No, I don't think you're being overly sensitive at all. I'm disturbed that this is part of a larger pattern of using sex. And, of course, we know that they've used sex to sell products for decades, generations. But this is, I think, part of a trend of using very overtly sexual imagery and messaging to target very young consumers. It's not just this. It's, you know, the Carl's Jr. hamburger ads advertising flat buns where they're, you know, teenage boys singing about their teachers' posterior. And I think it's just all over the top, unnecessary. And I'm very disturbed by the fact that Clearasil's creative team can't think of a better way to promote confidence in young
girls.
We
wanted to get a representative from Clearasil. Yeah. Here's their statement. Want to let everybody know. It says, our objective is to inform and entertain, not to offend. We have found that Clearasil consumers see this ad as we intended, a humorous and unrealistic presentation of an awkward family event. I don't know many awkward family events like that, I think we're going to have to leave it there. We've run out of time. This has been a good one. We appreciate it. Debbie Wolf with People Against Censorship and Melissa Henson
with the
Parents Television Council. Appreciate your time from both of you. And now we want to know what you think of this one. Do you think these ads are raunchy? Do you agree with me and think these are over the top, irresponsible at best? Or, hey, am I the prude here? Let us know. Email us, cnn.com/primenews. Click on the link. Email us, video mail us for that matter. Hey, they put me on TV. They might put you on as well.
Saw it. What's your attitude about these? How many of you think that that this is really over the top? It's not necessary. Maybe a third of us? How many of us think this is, since we're talking about ethics, this is actually unethical? It may not be unethical, but it's over the top and unnecessary. How many of you found it humorous, funny? Well, there's the other 70%, I guess, including our tech. So, should they be banned? This is over the top. It's unnecessary. It's sexualizing our teens. By the way, I have to explain to this lady how we know a 16-year-old boy might be horny. I'll explain that to her later. How many of you think that they should be banned? This sort of thing in our society is bad enough to ban it. How many of you think it should be censored? There ought to be a board that looks at this stuff and judges whether or not which the company is doing. One, are you raising your hand or are you just writing? One, not that many. How many feel that the consumer's response should be the main influence on what happens with the marketer? Okay, I will share with you, that's my particular response. What will people do if they truly find this offensive? What will they do? They'll stop buying the brand. What will the company do if they stop buying the brand? Stop the advertising. You can disagree. You have a different moral compass. I think that it should be the consumer in the marketplace helping to make these decisions. Because banning and censorship just take us down a whole different path. Clearasil clearly does not intend this to be offensive. Our objective is to inform and entertain, not to offend. We found that Clearasil consumers do see this ad as we intended, a humorous and unrealistic presentation of an awkward family event. And the fact that it spills over to another audience that isn't going to find it funny is the problem that causes some people to say marketing is bad, advertising is bad, etc. By the way, is this a surprise to you? How many people never heard that sex sells? Okay, so it is a thing. Speaking of, how many people have heard of Calvin's? Hashtag MyCalvin's. There are over 500,000 photos on Instagram tagged hashtag MyCalvin's. Most are selfies of lean 20-somethings in their beds and bathroom mirrors, proudly united by their cotton underwear bearing the name Calvin Klein. These unpaid, authentic posts endorsing the brand are an extremely powerful way to interact with young people, far more effective than the more obviously paid for influencer posts or printed ads. How many of you feel this is inappropriate? Don't be posting pictures of yourself in your underwear for the world to see. Nobody? All right?
Hi.
So not everybody's happy. As you would guess, not everybody's going to agree with this position.
Hi, I'm Heidi Zack, CEO and co-founder of Third Love. But more than that, I'm a strong and powerful woman and proud of it. I believe that women can do anything without limitation and that we aren't defined by our underwear. I'm personally offended by the Calvin Klein billboard ad in New York City that highlights a dated gender stereotype, that men are the breadwinners while women are sex objects. Women not only deserve respect, we demand it. The women of New York and women everywhere join me in saying we are no longer accepting this antiquated stereotype and instead are creating our own gender definitions, that a woman can be anything she wants to be.
I'm just wondering if you take a look at that billboard there, if you could give us your thoughts and reaction.
It's terrible. And it's offensive. I'm not happy about it, and I won't give Calvin Klein my money.
My comment is, that is as it should be. If you find it offensive, don't give them the money. Start a boycott complaint. Write them on social media. Beat them up if it's not appropriate. By the way, I don't know what it would have meant to have the woman's quote, I make money in my Calvin Klein underwear. That wouldn't have sounded right either. The guy says, I make money. She says, I seduce. I see the issue there, but let the consumer public decide. So this is as it should be. If consumers don't agree, they shouldn't buy the brand's products. They'll stop doing it. Now, in the in-person class, or if you're at home with your little kids and you're sensitive to this topic, please have them go watch some cartoons for the next minute. This is a minimum PG-13 ad coming up. So this is I flash in my Calvin's. Inappropriate. I see only two hands. Yeah. Oh, there we go. We got a few more people saying inappropriate. So you've crossed a line. This is tasteless. Another exponent of the hashtag voyeurgasm Uber trend. Peter Davis, editor at large at Paper Magazine, a peek up actress Clara Kristen skirt to glimpse her CK panties is not kiddie porn. It's sexy and sex sells. And Clara isn't 15. No one knows how to sell underwear and fragrances and clothing by promoting scandalous sex better than Calvin Klein. Every erotically charged fashion in post-Calvin Klein's golden era in the 70s and 80s owes everything to that brand, from Tom Ford to his infamously steamy and near-naked Gucci campaigns to Dolce & Gabbana's oiled-up men in Speedos. Sex gets attention, sex is sexy, sex sells. But people find it annoying. why do we do it? Because it gets results. Not everybody stops buying the brand. The hashtag MyCalvin campaign led to significant growth on Calvin Klein's social media platforms. Since the February 2014 launch, it's bulked its Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter followings by 2.2 million, 1.8 million, and 1 million, respectively. That's a lot of additional eyes on your product. Facebook currently, as of 12/21 when I looked at it, has over 13.7 million Calvin followers. As of that date, Twitter had 17.5 million, and Twitter has 3.7 million. People don't all seem turned off by this overt sexiness. It reached a global audience, surpassing 469 million fans, yielding 23.5 million in fan interactions. In July 2014, the brand expanded its advertising to Tinder. As Chief Marketing Officer Melissa Goldie explained, the platform is authentic and true to how this consumer communicates. As a direct result of the Bieber, Justin campaign, Calvin Klein benefited from 3.6 million additional followers across its social channel. If you don't like it, don't follow them. Don't buy their product. Go ahead and complain on your social media that you don't like it. But there are a bunch of people that don't find it that bad of a thing. They like it. In 2021, while the fashion industry in general and Calvin Klein in particular usually markets by being outrageous, P.G. Lange by Calvin Klein opts for relatable. In one especially comical video, Travis Bennett promotes his favorite Calvin Klein jeans without wearing said jeans. It's an oddball approach. We've seen Calvin Klein ads push many boundaries, but never quite like this. Dave called me and has this idea. We bounced it back and forth, Bennett tells us. P.G. Lange called me. P.G. Lange to me is creating with no boundaries as a cliche as it might sound. So this was a 2021.
Good. Yeah, I'm just finishing up right now. I can't believe that Calvin really gave me this, man. I feel really honored. This is crazy. It's like a big achievement. How's it look? It could look better considering how much they pay me for it. But I mean, dude, I'm gonna take home the money. And what they gonna do? Beat me up? I could have given a little more time and effort, but I mean, you know, I'm a little last minute with everything. So, did I blow it? No, I didn't blow it. No, I mean, I put a lot of me into it. I think when you see it, you'll notice that it's a lot of taco touch on there. A shout out on here? Okay, wait, I should know this. What's your last name again? Okay, getting mad at me isn't gonna help this. So what is your last name?
But it shows him on a billboard without pants. All right, let's move to some more positive issues of ethics. How about if we talk about socially responsible marketing? PepsiCo has an interesting sustainability plan. At PepsiCo, we believe there's an opportunity to change how the world produces, distributes, consumes, and disposes of foods and beverages in order to tackle the shared challenges we face. We aim to use our scale, reach, and expertise to help build a more sustainable food system, the one that can meet human needs for nutrition and enjoyment and continue to drive economic and social development without exceeding the natural boundaries of the planet. As well as being good for our business, working to realize this purpose is also the right thing to do. That sounds like the sort of ethics we were talking about when we first started this the other day. They have a recycling program. The U.S. is recycling less than half its bottles and cans. By the way, how many of you know that February is like Kent State Challenge Recycle Month? Have you seen that anywhere? That word hasn't gotten out very much. All right, never mind. So PepsiCo believes that bigger change starts with one bottle, one person, one action. You wouldn't mow just half your lawn or groom half your dog, so why not give more than 50%? Why not give 100% to recycling, too?
You wouldn't do something halfway, would you? In the U.S., we're recycling less than 50% of our bottles and cans. Join PepsiCo in the recycling of every last bottle and can.
Okay, so a bit of positive, social, responsible marketing, a bit of sustainable marketing, right, from them. A little bit of ethics there. So what is management's response to the need to be ethical? Well, one approach is to make sure it comes from the top and goes through the entire organization. So to have a corporate culture that focuses on ethics. So Vita has a statement in their mission and heritage statement. Our mission at Avita is to care for the world we live in, from the products we make to the ways in which we give back to society. At Avita, we strive to set an example for environmental leadership and responsibility, not just in the world of beauty, but around the world. That's an embedded idea of a corporate culture of ethics. That's one way to deal with it. Have a code of ethic, ways that you want your people to behave. What I say about ethics and your employees, you cannot control what your employees think, right? That's reasonable. You can't manage what people think. But you can control, manage how they act, what they do, their behavior. As a manager, you can have sets of rules that people must abide to. You may think it's stupid, but you can't steal. You can't cheat our clients. So you can set codes of ethics up for your employees. Can't control what they think, but you can control how they behave. Kraft Heinz Global Employee Code of Conduct, everyone's required to abide by this. Our code addresses every aspect of our business, and then it's going to go through all of the details of the code of conduct here. Another way that management deals with ethics. The behavior of top management. You can't run an organization where you're behaving in unethical ways, which again are the ones that make it in the news, and then expect your people to be ethical. You have to believe in what you're doing. I try not to lie, cheat, and steal. I don't want you to lie, cheat, and steal. So it starts at the top. Have an ombudsman for ethics. How many people know Kent State has an ombudsman for student, an ombuds for students? Nobody knows that? If you feel If you feel that you're being treated unfairly, if you're being harassed, if you're being sexually harassed, one place to go is to the student ombuds. Look them up on Kent's line. That person is going to help you with the issues and how to deal with them appropriately, because we believe in having you treated fairly throughout the organization and impartially, okay? American Red Cross has an ombuds for complaining about issues that are unethical. Independent, confidential, neutral, informal. Talk to these folks about the issues and problems that you might run into, whether you're an employee, a volunteer, or a partner. You have the right to contact the ombudsman. So managing the ethical environment of your firm and your employees is the way to go, is the important thing. You can't control what they think. You can control how they behave or fire them.
Very important to us. If you don't have the ethics and abide by those, it's hard for me, number one, to trust you and hire you. That's first and foremost. It's all about trust. So, we have a lot of belief in our people. We believe in them, unless they prove us wrong. Just like, I have children, like I mentioned, similar type situation. But, also believe we don't want to be deceptive in our pricing or advertising. We want to say, here's what we're doing and why, and be very upfront and honest. We don't want people coming back, a year later or even 6 months later, saying, hey, this isn't what you promised me, because you get into a lot of issues that way. I personally, coming from the telecommunications industry, saw a lot of the questionable ethical practices. Good example, one of the larger firms, MCI. They had a great company. We were competing head-to-head, and their growth rates were unbelievable, and we were getting bashed in the marketplace because of that at the time. We find out later, some of the things they were doing, the numbers were inflated quite a bit, and that whole house of cards came tumbling down. That could happen anywhere. I think Sarbanes-Oxley, even though I'm not an accountant, nor do I want to be, I think that's helped out, accountability. Processes and following that and the audits that go with that. So it's defined a lot of things that weren't there before. So that's helped out, but I'm going to be honest, ethics starts at the top and works its way down. If you're CEO, a vice president, it works its way down. If they're not ethical, that's the type of people they're going to hire. If they're ethical and they abide by standards and they adhere to those standards, I think that's where it starts, right there.
A million years ago, when computers were still fairly new, I would sell computers to small businesses. And we would make them promises about what these computers would do, and then we would deliver them, and it wouldn't do what we promised them to do. They were programmed wrong. So I would stay with that customer and reprogram the machine until it did what we promised it to do, right? Management was upset. Why don't you sell more computers? Because the one we sold him isn't doing what it's supposed to do. Occasionally I'd cold call, hi, how you doing? Would you like some computer today? Yeah, we'll come talk to you. We're suing your company from the last time you screwed us over. After a few years, and I did okay selling computers, but after a few years of that, we decided we didn't have the same view of ethics, of what you should be doing for the consumer, delivering on that promise. We parted ways friendly. Who knows? Accountants, anybody know Sarbanes-Oxley and what it is, what it represents? Can you talk out what it is, what it means?
Really layman's terms, it's like a viewpoint of accounting principles and regulations after a lot of companies got in various scandals for inflating and misrepresenting their accounting records.
Yep. And so the point is the CEO has to sign off that those financial records and statements are true, or the CEO is liable directly. You can't say, oh, it was my accountant over there, go talk to that person, right? So MCI lied about its financial wealth and its status, harming competition in the marketplace because nobody could keep up with their numbers. They were lying, which led to Sarbanes-Oxley. And then, by the way, at the very grassroots level, if I find out you lie, you cheat, you steal, I don't want to hire you. That's just silly. Why would I want to do that? So it plays out at a practical level as well. Fred Hunt talks about it. He's our guy over at Sherwin-Williams. Let's see if he's not going to work for us.
Now, the question of ethics in business today. I have a very long military background as well.
Let me back up and make sure that's going to work too.
Very important to us.
Yeah.
Very important.
Now, the question of ethics in business today. I have a very long military background as well as many years in industry. And it's been my experience that when it comes to speaking about ethics, it all starts at the top. It really does. In the case of Sherwin-Williams, we have an excellent executive staff who absolutely live by the ethics that you would expect and exceed that. Just an exemplary group of folks and push that those thoughts through every corner of the organization. I've yet to meet anyone in a position of decision making in this organization that made a decision that I felt at all uncomfortable with, nor would they even broach it. I mean, it just is a phenomenal place to be.
Benefit of having an ethical organization, ethics within your organization, managing people to be ethical, is it's a great place to work. Without telling me where, has anybody ever had a situation where you're working with a coworker who isn't ethical? Lying, cheating, stealing. Did you feel great every day you went to interact with them? No, unless you're in on the scheme. It makes you uncomfortable. It's not a great place to work. Manage your people better, people. So, and it all starts at the top, works its way down, and the frontline people have to be managed as well. So good business, good ethics is good business. Patagonia, who we talked about briefly before, was doing sustainable before most companies even knew what that meant. And now the brand is benefiting in interesting ways. Patagonia lately has been urging its outdoorsy customers to, quote, buy less and question whether they really need that several hundred dollar new parka even from them, even from Patagonia. The messaging has been suggesting they should just repair and keep using the $700 Patagonia parka that they already have instead of buying new ones. So this is a good, solid, sustainable, socially responsible stance. Patagonia's fans and customers are both joining the brand's sustainability cause and buying more new parkas from Patagonia. Sales increased almost one-third to $543 million, whatever year that was, which included about 9 months of the Buy Less marketing campaign. Patagonia founder and owner Yvonne Chouinard says, "I know it sounds crazy, but every time I've made a decision that's best for the planet, I have made money. Our customers know that, and they want to be a part of that environmental commitment. Good ethics is good business. Accenture Strategies Global Consumer Pulse Research revealed that consumers across all generations care about what retailers say and how they act. Consumers under 30, those belonging to Gen Z and millennial generations, feel a strong affiliation to retailers that subscribe to a larger purpose. More than 6 in 10 younger consumers closely consider a company's ethical values and authenticity before buying their products. It's a brand's responsibility to discover the topics that their target audience care about. Retailers have always had to understand their consumers, their buying habits, demographics, behavioral patterns. This is just another layer of understanding. How do they feel about social responsibility, sustainability, and ethics? For instance, Accenture's research found that companies that reduce plastics are more appealing to the baby boomer generation of 55 to 74-year-olds. Millennials and Gen Zers felt strongly about social mobility, immigration, and poverty. What do your consumers care about that's relevant to your mission, relevant to your organization, relevant to your business, and ethical? So, good ethics is good business. It's good for shareholders. They know that you aren't lying about your financial statements, that your profitability is honest. It's good for employees because they can trust one another. They can trust you. It's good for business partners because they know you're not lying, cheating, and stealing them. It's good for your customers and clients, same sort of logic. And it's good for society at large. You're setting good examples for the rest of society. Our organization in marketing is the American Marketing Association, and we're big on ethics as well. Here's their ethics statements. I won't go through the whole thing, but I'll flip through the whole thing. But the American Marketing Association commits itself to promoting the highest standard of professional ethic norms and values for its members. These norms are established standards of conduct that are expected and maintained by the society and or professional organizations. From their CEO, he says, in terms of diversity, equity, and inclusion, it's not a time for passivity. Positive intentions, altruistic motives, and empathetic sentiments are not enough. The AMA is confronting the insidious rot of racism in our society head on. We can do more, be better, and help be held accountable for turning tomorrow's hope into today's action. A change management expert once taught me that the change only occurs when there's a committed leadership from the top and universal dissatisfaction with the current state. Effective communication and adoption of dissatisfaction often begins with dramatic declarations that we are universally fed up with the status quo. Everyone in the marketing community deserves voice and influence with respect to this institution. Help us. We expect to hear the uncomfortable, but all of us have had it with the slow progress of racial equity and equality. The urgent and acute need to meet this moment of such hurtful racism and generational damage is our number one priority. Black Lives Matter. This, of course, came up during the Black Lives Matter time period, and this was his statement on it. So what do our norms include? Ethical norms. As marketer, we must do no harm, foster trust in the marketing system, embrace ethical values like honesty. In terms of responsibility, we have to be responsible, accept the consequences of our marketing decisions and strategies. Fairness, we need to balance justly the needs of the buyer with the interests of the seller. A list of things we'll do. Respect, we need to acknowledge the basic human dignity of all stakeholders. A list of things we need to do. Transparency, we need to create a spirit of openness in marketing operations. A list of things we need to do. Citizenship, to fulfill the economic, legal, philanthropic, and societal responsibilities that serve stakeholders. A list of things we need to do. We expect AMA members to be courageous and proactive in leading and or aiding their organizations in the fulfillment of the explicit and implicit promises made to those stakeholders. So, are there bad actors in the world? There are. Bad people in the world? There are. Are there bad brands? Are there bad manufacturers? Yes, yes, yes. Bad things do occur. And those are the ones that come to mind when I talk about negative things. There's a whole slew, masses of good people, good brands, good businesses doing good things in ethical ways. We want you to understand and do that as well as you move forward. All right, so that's the end of ethics and social responsibility in the marketing domain. We hit pretty heavily in this discussion about the need to understand your consumer. In our case, we were talking about, of course, understanding their ethical values. But obviously, if we're going to say that marketing shorthand is the discovery and the satisfaction of consumer needs, wants, and desires that are profit and integrated effort of the firm, we have to be able to understand the consumer and their needs, wants, and desires. So this takes us to the topic of understanding consumer behavior, chapter 5, lecture notes, page 72, I think. Back to our overview, the strategic framework for strategic marketing management. We're thinking about what's going on in terms of our B2B or B2C. Right now we're talking B2C consumers, understanding our consumer market. And so that's our focus right now as we assess market opportunities that are out there.
From the nonprofit.
This is Michelle Skin. She works for the Nonprofit Hospital Foundation. We heard from her a couple times already. She's thinking about the importance of understanding the consumer from her perspective.
From the nonprofit standpoint, marketing is a little bit different. For what I do, marketing is, number one, learning the motivation of my donor. And quite honestly, I don't think that you can market a product or a service without understanding and learning the motivation of your donor. And I think that that's above the price, promotion, place, maybe not product, but certainly understanding why that person would be interested in giving a donation or purchasing your car as opposed to one from General Motors. You have to understand the motivation, what gets people to do what they are going to do. And to me, it is understanding their motivation and then marketing what I do to that motivation.
And so we talked last time, I think we were together, about what were some motivations that somebody might have for donating. To give back, you really helped me, you helped a family member, you saved life, to make the world better. I want to support cancer research, to make a name for myself. I want the Marks Maternity Wing to represent me in the community. For financial gain, your donations are charitable contributions that reduce your tax burden. What's the motivation? Because you have to know what you're going to talk to the donor about. Likewise, in marketing a product, what are they interested in? What's your motivation?
Jeff, you started working at Macy's as a trainee 35 years ago, and now you're the CEO. You know, people dream about being the boss in charge of this iconic store. What's the key to your success?
You know, I'm a good listener, and I'm an avid learner. So just being a constant, perpetual learner and exposing myself to the brand the way the customer does is one of the secrets to my success. Wherever I'm going, my head is up. I'm looking at pop culture. What can I learn? What is the consumer digesting? What website should I be going to? I have a reverse mentor that is helping me learn about what the Gen Z customer is doing.
I do hear that you're very curious and that you ask lots of questions. Is there one question that you just keep asking over and over again everywhere you go?
What does the customer think? What's the customer reaction? She'll tell you. When I walk a store, I go to those associates, and you just ask them, what is the customer saying, and they will tell you. And you learn so much behind the strategy, where it came apart, where you didn't execute it right, what the need is. And our entire team of executives really are more focused on that frontline colleague than ever. You know, the customer is king on this, and we've got that frontline colleague that understands the customer better than any of us. So when she tells us what she needs and what she wants, those are marching orders. So when I bring that back to the store, I plug it in, and the organization responds.
Described as a pragmatic innovator. What does that mean?
You know, I think what's important about innovation is it's not a shiny penny. You've got to find something that actually can be bolted into the business that is serving the strategy that you've decided on. And ultimately, is it additive to the customer experience? So that's probably, you know, when you think about innovation and practicality, I want to make sure at the end of the day, does the customer value this? Is it going to drive shareholder value? Is it the right investment for us to make?
So he understands the importance of understanding the consumer. And one way of doing that is get to the frontline employees who talk to those consumers every day and understand what the consumers are saying, whether or not your strategy is working. If it's fine, do more of it. If not, take it back and adjust it. If you're going to think about innovation, think about it in terms of the consumer, not just because it's a new thing, a shiny new penny. Does it help fulfill the customer and their experience better? So he believes in this idea of understanding the consumer. So what does the customer need, want, and value? What motivates the customer? we have to understand what we're going to call consumer behavior. And today, we need to understand all of this in the context of the still ongoing COVID-related changes. What's it mean for our customers? All right. This model is adapted from Engel, Collett, and Blackwell's model of consumer behavior. We're going to walk through it because most of it's important. But just at a glance, you can see understanding the consumer is complicated. It's got a lot of elements to it. First of all, take note there are five top-level things we have to think about. One is what are called input variables, the things that are stimuli to the consumer, whether they're driven by marketers, by others. Those are things that influence a consumer. Information processing, how the consumer makes sense out of the world, the stimuli they come in contact with. External influences, culture, subculture, social class, family group, references impact the consumer as well. The decision process variables, their motives, which we just talked about, along with beliefs, attitudes, purchase intention. And then the decision process itself that drives them from recognizing they have a problem down to the outcomes and the response to whatever they do. That's the overall model. We just talked about motives a little bit. But let's start with the idea of what begins consumers' behavior. All right? We think that people buy things because they perceive a need for them. We think people don't go out and randomly buy stuff at random. Now, sometimes something's an impulse. You may not really need that Snickers bar, but you may want, okay, that's fine. It's still a need. But you don't go out and buy, I don't know, a car and shoes and kumquats and chewing gum and magazine randomly, right? There's some need there. So you perceive you have a need. Many times you search for a solution to your problem. Sometimes it's pretty quick, instantaneous. You know what you want. Sometimes it's elaborate. You have to do research. So we seek value out of the offerings that are there to satisfy our need. Then, having searched for a bunch of possible solutions, we have to evaluate those things that we've come up with that may satisfy our need. Do I want the Snickers bar? Do I want the Almond Joy? All right, so we have to assess the value we're going to get from our purchase decision. Choice is the idea of, quote, buying value, paying money or giving up time for the thing you want. Outcomes represent the idea of value in consumption, in use. Did it do what you wanted it to do? Did it satisfy you? Okay? So these are the key, the key elements in the five-stage decision process. So, problem recognition. How do you recognize you have a need? First of all, what is that? A need is your perception that there's a difference between your actual situation and your desired or your ideal situation. Anybody miss lunch today? Miss lunch? Yeah. So here I am babbling on, and you know it's not going anywhere at 5 o'clock, and I'm talking about Snickers and Almond Joy, and the more I'm talking about it, the hungrier you're getting. And okay, right? So you have a need, and that need is growing stronger over time and even distracts you from my exciting lecture as we talk about it, right? So if you had just had a massive football-size thing from Chipotle, well, it's the burritos, right? They look like footballs. You probably wouldn't really be that moved by my discussion of, you know, chocolate bars. I'm good. So a need is a perception that there's a difference between the actual state and the desired situation. These are influenced by your internal needs and motives, right? So you have a need to sleep occasionally. You have a need to have fun, to be social, to eat. Internally, I don't have to actually talk about that candy bar. You still knew you were hungry. It's internal. So we have internal needs and motives that drive our problem recognition. And fortunately, as marketers, you're also influenced by firms, which can activate problem recognition through our marketing communications that highlight, for example, limitations of the products that you already have. Your product doesn't do this. Or limitations of competitive products the products you're using don't do what our products do. This is actually true. I showed this for a number of years a while ago before I realized I had this problem and actually went out and solved it with this. So this particular thing is an HP printer. And when I had younger kids living at home, and my wife was at home, and I was at home, and we had to do printing, in the old day, somebody had to go upstairs, turn on the computer in order to get the printer connected to the computer to work. What a hassle that was, because the computer wasn't always on. And one day I actually read this, print from any room or age in the house. Live wirelessly. Print wirelessly. Holy mackerel! That's a solution. I went out and got myself an HP printer because I suddenly recognized, not only did I have a problem, here's a solution for the problem. Boom. Exactly as it's supposed to work. All right, so now we're going to search for a solution, okay? One place that we search for a solution is memory, right? So you run out of toothpaste. Do you now have to go to Consumer Reports, start checking for different brands, see what the latest social media comments on toothpaste are? Do you have to do a bunch of research on maybe in the aisle, start looking at boxes in their kind? Is that what you do when you need toothpaste? What do? You go and get the same one you got last time, right? I know what I want. I remember. I'm good. So one thing you can do is internally search memory. And what sorts of things do we recall? We recall things like the brand name, right? Easy enough. Do you ever not quite remember the brand name, but you know what the packaging looks like? That's one thing I think that some store brands, like CVS or whatever, play on. They'll put their brand right next to the other one. The color scheme is sort of the same. Maybe you'll grab it and try it and like it. So you might remember the brand name. Sometimes you remember the location in the store. I hate it when they move stuff in the grocery store. I can never figure out. So I just know it's down that, oh, there's what I want, right? So we recall different things from our memory. Sometimes we have to engage in external search. We look at things like market-dominated sources, thank goodness, salespeople, the web, advertisements, commercials, Super Bowl ads. We check personal sources, relatives and friends, and maybe our social media. We check public sources, Consumer Reports, and government agencies. And sometimes, of course, what happens is the last time you bought this product, you knew what it was. You knew everything there was. Internal memory is good. You bought a digital SLR camera. And at the time, you knew a lot about it, and you knew all the different mechanisms and what the various things were. And now it's 5, 7, 10 years later. Well, you know what you bought, but what you knew probably is no longer current. So you recall, you know what you knew, and now you have to go out and do more research because you just don't know how it's standing today. So you may go back and forth between internal search and external search for a solution to your problem. This is our buddy Shane Ducca, an affiliate marketer, and he talks a little bit about how providing information to consumers to help solve their problem is what he does as an affiliate marketer.
As an affiliate marketer, we add value in the process of buying something via education. What happens is if people want to buy something, they have a problem. Man, my back really hurts, you know, like best way to get rid of back pain. What happens is they'll Google that, they'll find affiliates who will then educate them on which direction they need to go in. As an affiliate, I would present a blog post or some kind of piece of content to educate that person about the three solutions to their back pain, and each one of them might have an affiliate link, which to go to a product, maybe a back brace, and that's how I would make money and basically be a part of that sales cycle. As an affiliate marketer.
So he has a little advantage in his situation. He's not trying to convince you to buy something that you have no interest in, haven't heard about, or haven't. You have a problem. That's why you've gone to his website, among others, to look for a solution. So you're actually searching for a solution, and he's giving you the top three back brace cures. He has an advantage to get your sale. All right, so how do we determine which of the various alternatives, options that we've come up with, we're going to choose? Well, this is the idea of the alternative evaluation process. And we think that, in many times, consumers think about the various criteria that they're bringing to the situation. These are the factors that represent the brand's characteristics as you perceive them, and you're going to use to compare and evaluate all the possible brand choices. So you have certain beliefs about Tesla, Toyota, Chevy, And those beliefs are probably elaborate. It's not just at the brand level, but at the detail level. And so you start thinking about the car purchase based on these evaluative criteria, the cost, the value, the trouble, the service, whatever it is for a car. So as a marketer, we have to understand what these evaluative criteria might be, and of course, legitimately, reasonably, influence them so the consumer's perception of our product, their beliefs about our product, their attitude about the product, are based on what we actually have to offer. I really do like some of these older things where we're comparing technology. So here's one where we see one of the brands thinking about the evaluative criteria that they believe consumers must consider.
Oh no, here we go again. Oh dear, I need a little help here. I'm sorry, I don't have a USB port. Oh snap, you have a real keyboard too? This isn't going to end well for me, is it? Nope, definitely not ending well. Do you still think I'm pretty?
You have a stand, you have a keyboard, you have a USB port, and you're cheaper than the other brand. Those are obviously what? The evaluative criteria that this brand feels should be important to the consumer, and they're trying to bring it to light to influence their beliefs and their attitudes about their brand versus iPad. In the COVID-19 era, as social distancing and protective measures have become the new norm, shopping from the home has been seen as safe and convenient. These factors now become evaluative criteria they didn't used to be for many purchases. For many marketers, this means rethinking how to connect with consumers. Clearly, a stronger emphasis on e-commerce and digital channels became crucial, including consideration of the role of direct-to-consumer e-commerce channels, different channels of distribution than we've been used to working with. So we've got to think about this. So consumers use their evaluative criteria to compare these alternatives and begin to, when they're thinking about things that are, you know, significant to them, begin to reduce it down from all the brands that are out there in their consideration set or their evoke set to ones that they're more interested in. So what we think happens is that their search, your search, should result in a group of brands. Now, again, if we're talking a candy bar or a toothpaste, we probably aren't going to have a big search. We're talking about something that's more complicated you feel you have to look around for. Brands that a consumer actually considers buying before making a purchase decision are known as the evoked set or the consideration set. Given your search, these are the most preferred alternatives. So out of all the brands out there, you do a search, and you can't very well search brands you don't know. If you don't know it, you can't very well consider it, right? Which is why I often emphasize the importance of marketers building brand awareness. If they aren't aware of you, they aren't going to buy you. So of the known brands then, you have some that are unacceptable, right? I'm not interested. They don't do what I need. You have some that are acceptable. And then, by golly, you have some that are overlooked. And oftentimes, V8 plays the role of the brand that's overlooked.
Look what mommy's having. Mommy's having a french fry. Yes, she is. Yes, she is.
Could have had a V8. 100% vegetable juice. With three of your daily vegetable servings in every little bottle.
So what V8 is trying to do is remind you that they're out there. Don't overlook that brand when you're thinking about your beverage choice, right? So of the evoked, of the acceptable brands, the evoked set, then there are some that are purchased and some are rejected. Of course, where do you want to be? Needless to say, the purchased brand, the chosen brand. But if you're in any of these other boxes, is it not important for you to do what? Understand why. Why doesn't the consumer consider you to be the best alternative? And what could you do to fix that? So this is a fairly important step in the decision-making process for consumers. So as the consumers evaluate these brands, they form beliefs about the brands, their attributes, their characteristics, whether or not they're good or bad for them. So they form these favorable and unfavorable attitudes. And the result of all this is an intention to make a purchase. what brand to buy, where to buy, when to buy, how to pay, based on this logical process, right? So now, if we act on the behavioral intention, we actually make the purchase. Yes? I can. That's okay. And I appreciate you stopping me. Otherwise, as you know, I just sail through. By the way, sometimes people have intentions to do things. They've logicked it out. They know what they want. And they don't act on it. So I'm going to do some research. I'm going to check. How many people are over 21 again? All right. I'm going to look at you. So I've checked you before you go into the store today. And I say, are you going to buy some beer today? And you say, yes, I am. I say, great. What are you going to buy? And you say, Michelob. That's what you plan to buy. Yes. You like it. Yes. So you're going to buy Michelob. I got my work done. He's going to buy Michelob. He comes out of the store. I said, hi, sir. Did you buy Michelob? And he said, I said, did you buy beer? Yes. Did you buy Michelob? No. Why not? What's some reasons he might not have acted on his intention? Variety. You know what? I got there and I saw there was such a choice and I'm always having Michelob and I saw Corona. I thought, man, I haven't had a Corona in a while. I'm going to have some variety. Well, wait a minute. You just told me you were going to, but variety became a factor. Why else might he not have bought whatever? Yeah. Stock, especially in these days of supply chain problems. There is no Michelob. I had to buy something else. There was a really great sale over here on this other brand. I bumped into my friend. My friend doesn't like Michelob. He likes Iron City beer. Anybody know Iron City beer? Iron City beer. All right. So there are a variety of factors that can impact the consumer as they don't act on their purchase intention. We want to get consumers that are brand loyal. No matter of any of those things, man, they're going to go find, whatever I said, Michelob. So this is the idea of acting on the intention. So acting on the behavioral intention by making the purchase. Who buys? We want to know. What family member? What person? What type of person? Where do they buy? Online? In a store? What kind of store? When do they buy it? Super Bowl Sunday. Okay, good. How do they pay for it? Might be important for us to know as well. So these are things we marketers need to know about the consumers and their behavior as they go to buy that value. We good? Okay. What happens when we buy the product? Well, we have some outcomes of our choice. And here what I say is you have some level of satisfaction, by which I mean you can be dissatisfied, neutral, or satisfied, or delighted. And at the same time, even when you're satisfied, you may also have some dissonance as well, especially in an important purchase where it was a little complicated to make the decision. So consumers make the purchase or choice based on their evaluations of the brands and on their purchase intentions. Then they evaluate whether their choice fulfilled their needs, their wants, their desires, solved their problem, which is why they bought the product. And I have a really nice little story that I want to tell related to understanding consumer satisfaction, but I don't have enough time to tell my story, so I'm going to end here. And with any luck, we'll see you on, who knows, Thursday, in person. We'll see you on the web. It's possible. Yeah, it's possible.